States against Fletcher. Mr. Boyoshki.
Good morning. May it please the court, this is the first appellate court to consider this matter. Four federal district courts, including the district court below, have considered it, and each have held in favor of the government and against the taxpayer. I think they're wrong. The facts of this case, as the district court found them, are undisputed. The applicable federal tax law is also undisputed. And the only reason we're here is because the district court below held, on public policy grounds, that the parties can contractually agree and thereby dictate federal tax consequences that are contrary to federal tax law. That holding flies in the face of the Supreme Court decision in Connolly, as well as this court's 1997 decision in Davon, and its decision 6 months ago in REI Transport. Now, those cases were not cited to or addressed by the district court below, but their principles were. And they each make it quite clear that federal law governs over any agreement by the parties. And that should be the end of this matter.
If the Capgemini stock had appreciated as your client had hoped, the tax return would not have been amended and you wouldn't be here at all, correct?
If the Capgemini stock had appreciated, the return would not have been amended?
Correct.
No, Judge, I think it would have been amended. And I think it would have been amended because the taxpayer was advised by tax counsel that the reporting was contrary to federal tax law.
She wouldn't have preferred to have the capital gains taxation on the appreciation that she would realize from that stock?
Clearly not, but she would also prefer to be in conformance with federal tax law.
So the amendment of the return was that she started to feel guilty about the return she'd filed for the 2000 tax year?
No, Judge. She knew at the time that she filed that return that the return was incorrect, and she was advised by counsel that it was incorrect. It overreported. But there was a reason why.
She signed that return.
She certainly did.
She's a CPA?
Not a CPA, but a consultant with Ernst & Young.
Pretty well-educated in matters that affect tax.
And she relied upon the advice of her tax advisor. And the tax advisor advised her that the way she was being requested to report that was contrary to federal tax law, but that bottom line is when you're in an elevator with a 600-pound gorilla, you might want to wait until you get out of the elevator before you poke a stick in its eye. And there was a risk here that Capgemini could claim, incorrectly, but claim, that she was in breach of contract if she filed the return differently from what they requested her to do. And this is spelled out in the findings by the judge. Bottom line is she was advised that since she had a 3-year statute of limitations for filing an amended return, that she should wait and see if she was still in the employ of Capgemini. In other words, see if she was out of the elevator first.
Counsel, am I understanding you correctly that this means that your client knowingly filed with the IRS what she believed to be a false income tax return and believing that she could substitute a true one later, so that her signature on the return was, by your current account, perjury? Because the signature verifies that this is true and correct to the best of my belief. And you're now representing that your client lied, intentionally lied, when filing her early return, her initial return, because she planned to tell the truth at some later day should that be convenient to her.
Well, I appreciate the point, Judge.
Is that your position?
No.
Then I don't understand your answer to Judge Stender's question.
And I'm wondering as well, isn't there something done called like a Fifth Amendment return where you just file a return and you don't report the amounts, but you pay the tax?
Well, yes, but there's a difference.
You're concerned about the nature of the transaction.
There's a difference here. If the taxpayer had underreported, it would be quite a different story. But what the taxpayer here has done is to over-report.
The signature on the return doesn't say, I've avoided under-reporting. It says, I have made a true and correct return to the best of my knowledge.
Yes. I appreciate the point. But under the circumstances where she was placed in the position she was and with the advice that she got from her tax advisor, she felt that she had no choice but to file that return, which over-reported her income. And true, it is not a true and accurate return in those returns.
Over-reported her income for that year and put her in a position to turn ordinary income into capital gains for many future years. That is, this was a return that had people's beliefs about the future market price of these entities been correct, would have been very advantageous to her. She amended the return only when it turned out, in light of market developments, that it was not advantageous to her.
Well, she believed at the time that she filed it that she was going to have to amend. The question was whether she was going to still be in the employ of Capgemini. But in answer to your question, yes, she intentionally over-reported.
Said, I think you've now essentially pleaded your client guilty to perjury.
And her accountant to some
yes.
trouble on his
well,
part.
I think the difficulty here is that at least the tacit requirement of Capgemini and of Ernst & Young was to require this taxpayer to report that way. So they were the ones that were requiring that it be reported that way.
Your position is that if Capgemini tells your client to knowingly violate federal law, your client is obliged to violate federal law? You must be kidding.
Well, I would couch that differently, Judge, and that is that it isn't a violation of federal law as long as they have the opportunity to amend the return. And the statute of limitations here is 3 years.
So,
and under
so
the
that
circumstances,
oath is really a little different. This is what I'm submitting now, but I might change this later.
Yes. Well, and the filing of a return has that possibility with it at all times. Sure, as long as you're within the statute of limitations to amend.
Discover things, new things. I must say, the idea that you can file a return, you can sign the return knowing that you're signing a false return, that you're making a false report of income and deductions, if you plan to change it later, would be an extraordinary change in federal law and, of course, contradict what the return says.
Well, keep in mind that the position that she was taking and that she was advised is it was contrary to federal tax law. The position of Capgemini and of Ernst & Young is that that's what was required.
She kept that well under her hat, though, I take it. She didn't assert that to Capgemini people or anyone other than her accountant, I take it.
That is true. Not until she terminated her employment with Capgemini. That is correct. That is correct. But the question at the bottom line is, what is the proper treatment under federal tax law? And briefly, what happened in this case is that the four major accounting firms had a conflict of interest because of their representation of clients for audit and tax purposes, and they saw a potential conflict because of the large consulting contracts. And so, at the urging of the SEC, accounting firms divested themselves of their consulting arms. And the federal tax consequences to these partners of that divestiture are what is the question in this case. The taxpayer was a consulting partner with Ernst & Young. She transferred her interest in Ernst & Young's consulting practice to Capgemini, a French international consulting firm who was the purchaser. And in exchange, Capgemini placed shares of its stock in a restricted account with Merrill Lynch. The question in the case is whether that restricted account or anything in it is taxable to the taxpayer when the account was set up in 2000, or instead is taxable only when and if released to her. Let me add here, and maybe to a certain extent this responds to your question, the government's position is that this should be reported in 2000. In other words, that it should be reported the way it was reported in the initial return, because they believe that is the proper interpretation of what the tax law requires. So that to the extent that the taxpayer felt differently, certainly the government didn't, And they are the ones mandating now that it be reported contrary to federal tax law. They are the ones who are requiring here that it be reported in, to use the same words, in a fraudulent context. The taxpayer must report it the way the Internal Revenue Service wants it because that is the federal tax law as the government interprets it.
But underlying that is the agreement that she entered to structure it as present payment. That's what's behind the tax effect.
Well, the difficulty is that it's very clear under the contract that there was no receipt of stock. There was no receipt of stock. It was deposited directly into a Merrill Lynch account that was controlled by and only by Capgemini. It was from one pocket of Capgemini to the other pocket of Capgemini. And the statute and the regulations and the rulings are all uniformly in accord that is not receipt as defined by her accounting method, which was the cash receipts and disbursements method of accounting.
The Merrill Lynch account is in her name, correct?
It's identified with her name, but it's expressly restricted to access only by Capgemini and not by the taxpayer. At no time did she have any access to that account and expressly couldn't sell any interest that she might have in that account. It was expressly prohibited under the agreement.
What happened to the dividends?
I'm sorry?
What happened to the dividends?
What happened to the dividends? There were no rights to dividends. There was a provision that allowed the dividends at the discretion of Capgemini to be paid. And that's only dividends, by the way, on the Capgemini stock. For example, if anything else was in that restricted account, if it was reinvested in some other stock, there was no provision with respect to that. The dividends were, in fact, distributed. The question of why they were distributed is not answered by this record. But it's also clear, and the government admitted, that there was no right to those dividends. I guess the bottom line of what we...
To be sure I understand your position about the status of the account, this appears to be a difference of opinion between you and the IRS. Suppose she had sent a direction to Merrill Lynch to sell 100 shares out of that account. What would Merrill Lynch have done?
Asked Capgemini what they wanted to do.
So your position is they would have done nothing.
They couldn't, under the express...
I gather the IRS's position is they would have sold 100 shares for her account, but there might have been contractual consequences.
No, Judge, they could not. They could not because under the agreement with Merrill Lynch, as well as under the express power of attorney that was signed in the transaction documents that are the contract here, the taxpayer had no authority and was so found in this case by the judge and admitted by the government that they had no ability to direct anything in that restricted account, nothing. And Merrill Lynch would not honor any direction they made. Keep in mind that we have an overriding power of attorney here, irrevocable, plenary, exclusive, that says they can do nothing and that Capgemini can act, quote, in any way, including a retroactive rewriting of the contract and a waiver of the taxpayer's rights. It's an extraordinarily broad power of attorney that was required to be entered into weeks before the closing date of this transaction, and it was required in order to participate in the transaction. So there was nothing left for the taxpayer at the time of closing. There was nothing that they could do. Yes, they could request that this be done and that be done, but only would it be followed if Capgemini endorsed it. Once we take into consideration this power of attorney, and the express directions to Merrill Lynch, the problem is that there was absolutely no ability of the taxpayer to do anything with respect to that restricted account. Couldn't access it, couldn't sell an interest in it, couldn't do anything with it. And Capgemini held all of the cards. And that's precisely a situation where the federal tax law, not only in the statute and regulations, But in the published administrative position of the Internal Revenue Service, addressing situations where stock is escrowed, as we have here, and that stock is not accessible, and the benefits of it are not accessible, federal tax law is very clear, the administrative position of the Internal Revenue Service is very clear, and that's where this case should end. I see that I have no time for dread.
It's expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Tamami.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Francesca Tamami, counsel for the United States. What this case is about is the taxpayer entered into a valid agreement, a valid transaction with Capgemini. Taxpayer, Ernst & Young, and about 500 other consulting partners like Taxpayer. There's no argument here that the transaction itself, any of the transaction documents, were invalid in any way. The transaction afforded Taxpayer the opportunity to realize significant capital gains in the future if the Capgemini stock had appreciated in value. This was something that all of the consulting partners were looking forward to. It would give them an opportunity to realize something of much greater value than arguably their Ernst & Young partnership interest was worth at the time. Unfortunately, the Capgemini stock value completely tanked. The taxpayer is now seeking not to undo any other aspect of the transaction, simply the tax consequences of the transaction. We've heard a lot about the taxpayer has framed this case as, well, I entered into a transaction that violated federal tax law, and I can't be held to that. Nothing here was a violation of federal tax law. That's a rather strong phrase. There's the position that the district court's finding and the government's position in this case is that you can apply the tax law either to the form of the transaction or you can look at the substance of what happened. In most cases, hopefully, the form and the substance are the same.
If I understand Fletcher's argument correctly, it is that the form of the transaction is what it is, and they're bound by the form of the transaction. They can't disclaim any part of the form. Commissioner might be able to recharacterize, but taxpayers can't. But if you take the form as exactly how it was set up, there was no income the first time around. Income accrued only when the shares became available. Right? That doesn't sound like an effort to recharacterize. It just sounds like an argument that the correct legal consequence of the form they chose was one thing rather than another. What's wrong with that line of argument?
Because that treats her receipt of the consideration as solely a federal tax concept, as something that could not be fixed by the contract. Here, the fact of receipt, if you're leaving tax consequences aside, tax concepts aside, the transaction documents clearly show an agreement as to payment.
Suppose the transaction were of the form that the consulting operation is sold to Capgemini. Capgemini will issue shares in exchange for the partnership interest 5 years in the future. Right? You'll see nothing for 5 years, but we will report it as income now because we would like to turn ordinary income into capital gains right now. So that's the form of the transaction. Partnership sold now, shares received in 5 years. And we'll assume that Fletcher is an income taxpayer rather than an accrual taxpayer. In what year does Fletcher have to report the income? Now or 5 years from now?
First of all, I think that's a different case from this case.
Of course it is. It's a hypothetical. That's why they're called hypotheticals.
Right.
In what year does Fletcher owe the income?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, in that case, if the transaction documents clearly were to state that the consideration is not going to be paid for 5 years from now, then presumably, under the proper application of the federal tax laws, the income would not be reported until the consideration was paid.
Now suppose I modify that hypothetical and say Capgemini agrees, you know, the parties agree to report the income as received in year one, even though the shares won't be received, won't be transferred until year five. Now, in what year is the income now received, according to the commissioner?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the variation?
Look, we've agreed that if the transaction is she sells her partnership interest in year one and Capgemini doesn't pay anything until year five, that since Fletcher is a cash basis taxpayer rather than an accrual taxpayer, she receives no income until year five. Right? Now we've changed this contract, and the contract now says, but we all agree that we will report to the IRS that all of this income was received in year one. In what year is the income received? In year one or in year five?
Well, in that case, I mean, of course, if it's truly a complete fiction that the taxpayer has received anything in year one, then presumably the IRS would challenge the reporting of that transaction and say you can't agree to report something in a certain way when it's a complete fiction.
Right.
But in this case,
that then is, I think, the question presented by this case. And complete fiction is the wrong way to describe it. In both the real transaction here and in my hypothetical, the facts have been reported exactly as they are. Right? The form of the transaction is what it is, and we now need to decide the legal consequence of that. But your answer to my second hypothetical says, I hear you say, the taxpayer can't decide the legal consequences of the form. The taxpayer picks the form. And then the law picks the consequence when the tax is due. But that, to come back to where I began, I understood Ms. Fletcher, to be making exactly this argument, that, sure, they picked the form, she's stuck with the form, but if you look at this form, the legal consequence is the tax wasn't due immediately, it was due later. Why is that a bad argument? It doesn't look like they're disagreeing with their own form. You've briefed this as if the taxpayer can win only if she gets to reject the form. But it doesn't look to me like she's trying to reject the form. It looks to me like there's a dispute about the legal consequences of that form.
Well, I think that ignores the fact that the parties that were at this bargaining table, and this is hearkening back to this notion of the Danielson rule, the parties
Danielson rule says they can't reject the form. But as I say, they're not trying to reject the form. They're arguing about the legal consequences of the form.
But I think here, and the district court determined based on the evidence, that the parties here entered into this deal with an understanding of to the degree that maybe there's some uncertainty under federal tax law as to what year she received the stock, which the government does not concede. The government's position is that if you're looking truly just at the substance of the transaction, if you apply the various code provisions and regulations regarding receipt, we would still maintain that the taxpayer received all of this stock in 2000.
Counsel, for the stock taxpayer said it was an escrow. This was an escrow arrangement. Do you agree with that?
I don't think they used the term escrow. They called it custodial accounts, but I guess the escrow situations would be basically similar cases.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to get back to answering your question. The parties went into this deal recognizing that to the extent there might be any uncertainty as to when the consulting partners received income, we want to structure this in a way such that the deal is closed in 2000, because that has identifiable tax consequences for all of the parties involved. It fixed Capgemini's basis in the workforce it acquired, which was the predominant asset it acquired.
That, but that's my second hypothetical. They're going to pay her in year five, but they agree they have their good reasons for thinking that they want the income taxed as if it had been received in year one, and that they have sound business reasons for wanting it done that way. But you had told me that that doesn't make it taxable in year one. It's still taxable in year five because that's the form. That's when it was received. So I don't see why the fact that there are sound business reasons changes it. We've already done that in the hypothetical. Let me ask Judge Ripple's question, because it was a question I asked to Mr. Boyarsky. If Fletcher calls up Merrill Lynch and says, sell 100 Capgemini for my account, what happens?
I believe that she was only permitted to sell stock at the scheduled offerings for the first five-year period. So, and it was the CEO of CGENY, the consulting entity that was formed after this deal, that had the power of attorney to effectuate the restrictions contained in the transaction documents. So if she had attempted to instruct Merrill Lynch to sell stock at a period that was not during one of these scheduled offerings, then I believe her request would have been rejected. But during at the time of the scheduled offerings, she was free to state the minimum price she would accept for the stock, decide how many shares she would sell. She wasn't obligated to accept any certain price. She wasn't even obligated to sell. The restriction was just that you can only sell during these certain periods. And this was something that was agreed to. It was a restriction that was also imposed on Ernst & Young, the firm, which acquired Capgemini stock, and that all of the consulting partners agreed to, because the transaction doubled the number of shares of Capgemini stock that were on the market. This was publicly traded stock in Paris. And had the parties been able to sell the stock at any time, it would have caused the stock value to drop. So I guess actually,
I don't understand that. That's not consistent with normal principles of finance. The value of the stock depends on its expected future returns, not on the number of shares that are bought and sold on Thursday. Was this a Rule 147 problem, perhaps?
I think the fear was that the market would be flooded with shares, perhaps
That's just grade school economics. There's no support for that in finance. And these are sophisticated people. They don't behave in that way. My question is there a Rule 147 problem? That is this a problem of registration under the Securities Act of 1933, which for control persons, that is prescribed insiders, makes it not lawful to sell other than in a prescribed amount specified in the rule?
To my understanding, the stock was not registered with the SEC. It was.
All right, so this might be a Rule 147 consideration.
I'm just offering the court the testimony of Arthur Gordon. He was the Capgemini representative that was deposed in these cases. I don't have any other independent knowledge about the stock, and that was his testimony as to why they negotiated for these sale restrictions. But I guess getting back to your original question about isn't this just part of the form, and don't the tax consequences flow from the form? I guess my response would be that the form of the transaction clearly was that the consideration was to be delivered on the closing date, and the parties would walk away from that and owe nothing further to one another.
Well,
although the form of...
Suppose this is not stock, and suppose the structure of the transaction is, on the closing date, $1 million is deposited in an account with Fletcher's name on it, but that account is blocked, right? Not one penny can be drawn for 5 years. What's the tax consequence of that?
Again, that would require a trial in which you determine what are the...
You can tell me what the tax consequence of that is. It's either taxable or it isn't. It doesn't require a trial.
My guess would that it would not be considered taxable under the Internal Revenue Code provisions. But again, I think this is exactly why you have the Danielson rule and this body of law that says...
Look, I thought we've already agreed this is completely outside Danielson. The taxpayer can't question the form. We try to figure out the tax consequence of the form. Now, if it's your view that $1 million deposited in an account with Fletcher's name on it, but completely blocked for 5 years, is income, not now, but in year five, why does it matter that the thing in the blocked account is stock rather than dollars?
I think if you look at the economic reality, what she received in 2000 still improved her net worth. She exchanged something that was arguably less liquid than what she received, her partnership interest in Ernst & Young, which she never would be able to sell, never would be able to assign. Instead, exchanged it.
$1 million in cash improves her net worth.
So
right?
She
there is no debt. Suppose you have a partnership interest that if you capitalize the future income stream attributable to the partnership interest, it would be worth $500,000. As part of this sale, they deposit $1 million in the account now. Right? One could say, you could have said, that is a $500,000 capital gain or maybe ordinary income right now, and it's taxable right now, even though none of this money can be withdrawn for 5 years, because it improves her net worth. If she reports to a bank and she's going to borrow, you know, to buy a new home, that's part of her net worth. They can't take it away, but it's received, right? It's deposited now but can't be touched for 5 years. But you told me in the answer to that question that that's not income now. It's income in 5 years when you can access it. My question is, why is stock different?
Well, perhaps I would want to change my answer to your initial hypothetical.
All right.
Because I don't think that, first of all, the government would dispute that the taxpayer has framed the the receipt question, we would not necessarily concede that this is a question decided under Section 451, which brings in all these questions about dominion and control. There's other code provisions, Section 1001, that arguably would be apply to this kind of transaction where you have a sale or exchange of a property interest. So I think the federal tax result is not as clear-cut as taxpayer would have it. Going back to what this person received in 2000, I think no one would dispute that she received something of value in 2000. Certainly there were restrictions on what she received, but that, I think, would go more to the value of what she received. Perhaps it's too indefinable. However, in this case, the taxpayer contractually agreed that she would value what she received in 2000 at a 5% discount. And that clearly was a factual agreement in the transaction.
Okay. So your position then, I think, if I'm now getting it, is either stock or money deposited into a blocked account in year one, right, will be unblocked in year five. Deposited in year one is income in year one, despite the fact that it can't be used. And the only question is how much discount should be subtracted for the illiquidity of the asset between year one and year five.
That's correct.
All right. So you're revising your answer to my hypothetical.
I am, if I'm permitted to do so.
Certainly. We're just trying to figure out what the tax consequences are, and the answers are just tentative.
I see that I'm out of time. If the court has any further questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I don't want to go over my time with any further portion of my argument, other than to ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But by the way, can I ask us from the perspective of gift tax?
I will do my best to try to answer it.
If somebody gives money to, you know, a relative, and it's in a blocked account, it can't be reached till the relative's age of majority. When does the IRS treat that as a gift? In the relative's age of majority when the money can be reached, or in the year when it's put into the blocked account or into the trust?
I honestly don't know, but my gut reaction is because I think the gift tax is imposed on the donor, and it's imposed on that exercise of making the gift, of the donor separating with the money, that it would be imposed at the time the donor makes the gift, regardless of the restrictions on the donee's receipt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's just my own personal take on it without having checked any of the Internal Revenue Code provisions.
Unfair question. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Although your time has expired, Mr. Boyarsky, Ms. Tamami got a couple of extra minutes, so I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Judge, with respect to the hypothetical that you posed, there are cases that involve mere passage of time where you're absolutely assured of getting something, and the question is, well, there's just going to be 5-year delay and you'll get it then. But what you have then is a right to something now that's assured. One of the problems here, and in fact the critical problem here, is that this taxpayer didn't have a right to anything. She was not assured of anything. There were substantial limitations and restrictions. There were a number of things that were totally outside of her control that could happen at the instance of Capgemini to stop this. And keep in mind that power of attorney expressly stated that it was broad enough to have Capgemini retroactively rewrite this contract and waive taxpayer rights. That's an express provision of this contract. Very broad power of attorney indeed. The problem here is that we aren't dealing with mere passage of time. We're dealing with a question of how many sticks did she have? What dominion and control did she have over this account? And where you give as a hypothetical that you're definitely going to get it in 5 years, that's a very different situation than what we had here. Are there any other questions from the court that you wish for me to address?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.
Thank you.